Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the funny part about the president's budget plan that was released today. It's for a fiscal year that's basically half done already. Fiscal year 10 expires at the end of September. But that is still plenty of time to spend a whole lot of money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 26th of February. Good to have you with us. And let's do this, just to be different. Let's not concentrate on how much the government's going to spend. There will be time enough to do that later, and we will, because it is a whole boatload of money. Instead, let's have a look at what is arguably the harder part of what President Obama promised to do today. Trim the nation's budget by $2 trillion over the next 10 years, even as he tries to get the economy going again. So clearly, something's going to have to give, right? From Washington, Ronnie Radbill reports on what that might be.
So how does President Obama cut the deficit by $2 trillion?
We're going to go through our books page by page, line by line, to eliminate waste and inefficiency.
But the question is, what waste and inefficiency? Much of the savings is expected to come from closing tax loopholes, rolling back tax cuts for the rich, and huge cuts in defense spending. The president wants to withdraw troops from Iraq and rethink expensive weapons systems.
We will end no-bid contracts that have wasted billions in Iraq and end tax breaks for corporations that ship jobs overseas.
Tax journalist David K. Johnston says choking off loopholes will save a bit of cash.
We have entire industries now in the United States that earn all of their profits from hidden subsidies from the government.
More money is expected to come from slashing some education programs and some government farm subsidies. But the biggest savings, roughly $300 billion over 10 years, will come from drastically overhauling Medicare, Medicaid, and other entitlement programs. Stan Collender, partner at Corvus Communications, says that's Washington's biggest challenge.
The compromises are going to have to be pretty intense. We'll see how much political capital the president really has to make that happen, but I would bet that's going to be the toughest of all the things he's trying to do.
And Collender says much of getting this budget through will also depend on lady luck. No sudden crisis at home or abroad, and congressional approval on the whole blueprint, which isn't going to come easy. In Washington, I'm Ronnie Radbill for Marketplace.
There is a certain element of you've got to spend money to save money in the president's budget plan. He's promising a major overhaul of the healthcare system with universal coverage in a decade. But the price tag on that is a doozy, $684 billion over those 10 years as a down payment. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now on how he's going to get there.
Some $600 billion sounds like a lot for universal health care, but analyst Steve Brozak at WBB Securities argues we don't understand how expensive our health care is right now.
Most people have a better idea of the real cost to get an oil change on their car than what it really costs to get a CAT scan. That's pretty ridiculous.
In fact, the government says the U.S. spends more than $2 trillion a year on health care now, and millions of people don't even get coverage. The new plan pays for the reforms in two ways, taxes and spending cuts. The Obama administration would phase out tax cuts enacted during the Bush administration for people who make more than $250,000 a year. And the new plan would shrink payments to Medicare by $316 billion. That's the system that funds health care to the elderly and disabled. Miller Tabak analyst Les Funtleiter wrote the book Healthcare Investing. He says without reform, the economy suffers.
America is at a disadvantage to other places in the world who have single-payer systems. It does put a burden on our companies. I mean, even China has said they wanted to do a universal healthcare program.
Some Republicans complained today that the president's proposal is too expensive. They don't want to see breadwinners taxed more during a recession. But Len Nichols with the nonpartisan New America Foundation says lawmakers may be closer to compromise than they let on.
I know there is far more bipartisan conversation going on, at least on the Senate side, than is perhaps evident in public.
That behind-the-scenes wrangling will probably continue for a few more weeks. More details about the plan are expected to emerge in April. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
One more budget note before we move on. A nod back to the president's speech to Congress Tuesday night. That part where he said he's going to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. Take his figure today of $1.75 trillion in budget deficit this year. Cut that in half, and it's still a really big number. There's probably going to be a deal between Citigroup and the government any day now. If the guesses are right, it's going to involve increasing taxpayer stake in the bank to around 40%. Whether that's nationalization or not is a topic for another day. The question at hand right now is how that deal would work, because the government's already got $45 billion bet on Citi's survival. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
When Washington stepped in with billions for Citigroup, it took convertible preferred shares in return. Now, unlike common shares, the government stake doesn't give it voting rights at the bank. But, says Sanford Bernstein analyst Brad Hintz, preferred shareholders get priority when it comes to dividends and liquidation.
So it's sort of halfway between a bond, where they're going to pay you off at the end, and halfway between a stock. You don't get quite the return of a stock, but you get a somewhat higher return than a bond.
It was less risky for the government to take preferred shares, and not having voting rights was seen as a good thing. Here's the problem. Hintz says investors used to count preferred shares just as they counted common shares.
So when they talk about the leverage ratio of a company, in other words, how much capital it has relative to the assets that it has, they'd include preferred.
But, he says,
the market is now become so skeptical that they're saying the only thing that will count is common.
To convert to common stock, the government would pay around $2.50 a share. That's about 10% of what the stock was worth just 5 months ago. Morningstar analyst Jamie Peters says if nothing else, it would be a major confidence boost. You know, the government hanging out down in the trenches with common investors.
Basically, shareholders are worried that this company is so levered that additional losses could basically wipe out common shareholders. So if you bring the government in with a new common share stake, there is now a bigger cushion before common shareholders would be wiped out.
Of course, it would also put taxpayers at greater risk of being wiped out, unless, that is, the government keeps pumping money in. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
All those zeros in the president's budget didn't do much for Wall Street today. That and a big jump in oil prices helped send the major indices lower. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The budget plan that the White House released today is remarkably slim for all the money it proposes to spend, just 140 pages to dispense with $3.5 trillion. Of course, the details are still to come, as is more information about exactly how President Obama plans to deal with some of the budgetary problems that are now on his plate. Writer and commentator Lawrence Haas says not all of the proposals being bandied about are good ones.
There's a really lousy idea floating around Washington. The idea is that Congress would create a commission of private experts to draft a plan to balance the budget. Democrats and Republicans in Congress are supposedly too divided to agree on tax increases and spending cuts. So the commission would draft a plan, and then Congress would enact it. This is no fly-by-night proposal. Its proponents include important members of the Senate and House and some of Washington's leading private experts. The problem is, the idea is based on two myths. The first myth is that a commission working outside the partisan atmosphere of Congress can easily draft a plan. History suggests otherwise. In 1987, Congress created the same kind of commission to draft a plan to balance the budget. Guess what happened? The 14 prominent individuals, most of them private citizens, could not reach agreement. Eight members issued one report, the other six issued another. Congress did not vote on either one. Then in 1993, Congress created another commission, this one to draft a plan to control the costs of entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. Guess what? That panel never agreed on a plan either. The second myth is that Congress will never be able to draft its own plan. Here again, history suggests otherwise. In 1990, Congress worked with the first President Bush to enact a five-year plan to cut deficits by half a trillion dollars. Then in 1993, Congress worked with President Clinton to enact another five-year plan to cut deficits by another $500 billion. Both plans succeeded, and by 1998, the budget was balanced. That's how it's supposed to work. The president and Congress see a problem and fix it. That's why we elect them. Now, a new president and Congress again face huge deficits that threaten our economic future. They should address the problem, not delegate it to a commission that wasn't elected by anyone.
Lawrence Haas was the communications director at the Office of Management and Budget during the Clinton administration. We would love to hear from you about what you hear on the program. You can write us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The Obama administration's economic program isn't all banks and bailouts and budgets. Vice President Joe Biden heads to Philadelphia tomorrow. He'll be leading the first meeting of a White House task force on revitalizing the middle class. And the very first order of business is going to be how green jobs might help do that. The stimulus package has billions in it for alternative energy. But while the feds are ramping up on green, the states are busy pulling back. As Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
This year, 46 states have budget deficits, some of them huge. Legislators are scrambling to close the gaps. That means programs that were widely supported in good times are suddenly vulnerable, like New York State's Environmental Protection Fund.
This is a critical fund.
Ned Sullivan heads the nonprofit Scenic Hudson. He says New York's fund pays for everything from preserving farmland to treating wastewater. But legislators just slashed the fund's budget 20% and could cut more. For one, that means less money to buy land for parks and recreation along the Hudson River.
And yet this is a time when real estate prices have come down, when we could move forward with critical land preservation projects that would preserve the must-save lands along the Hudson.
On the West Coast in California, clean air rules fell victim to the state budget crisis. California requires a near-impossible two-thirds majority to pass a state budget, so Republicans demanded and won some controversial concessions, not all related to the budget, according to Bill McGovern, director of Sierra Club California. They included a delay in new rules requiring builders to retrofit bulldozers and other soot-spewing equipment. Diesel emissions are linked to both heart and lung disease.
Particulate emissions from diesel exhaust are much more dangerous than people used to think that they were. We're finding out more and more, and as the chair of California's Air Resources Board has said, people will die because of this delay in cleaning up diesel pollution.
California and New York have plenty of company. Adam Schaefer watches legislation from his perch at the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators. He says environmental rollbacks and budget cuts are happening in many states right now.
We saw this back in 2001 when states had a shortfall at that time, and environmental budgets were on the chopping block as well. So
the deja vu includes campaigns by pro-business lawmakers to relax permitting rules for new development. That debate is underway in states like Florida. There, Republicans are pushing for less state regulation in order to stimulate the economy and create jobs. State Senator Mike Bennett of Bradenton, Florida, is one of them.
Here is the perfect opportunity to cleanse our system. Why does it take 7 years of engineering and planning to start a road construction project? It just doesn't make sense.
The flood of federal stimulus money coming to the states could temper the effect of state environmental cuts. Take California. It's delaying pollution rules for bulldozers and such. But Adam Schaefer points out the state will get federal money for retrofits on diesel school buses and commercial trucks. Sierra Club's Bill McGovern, though, isn't happy about the mixed signals.
The federal stimulus package will help in certain areas, but it will not repair all of the damage done by our state budget process.
McGovern says California budget negotiators did resist one Republican demand that certainly would have made national headlines, delaying implementation of the state's landmark law that caps greenhouse gas emissions. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, downsizing into the world of franchising.
I asked them what was the hardest part, and most of them said, doing everything myself. I had a corporate staff before. Now I have to wash the toilet.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 1.2% today, 88 points, closed at 71.82. The NASDAQ retreated 2.3%, 53 points, ended at 1391. The S&P 500 lost 1.5%, that is 12 points, finished at 752. The proposed budget from the White House dealt a blow to healthcare stocks. Humana slid 19.5% today. Aetna tumbled more than 11%. Merck fell nearly 6.75%. Most financial stocks went in the other direction. Bank of America ended the day up just over 3%. JP Morgan Chase put on 6%. Wells Fargo deposited 7.1%. IBM also had a good day. Its shares surged 3.5% after the computer giant reaffirmed that it is going to have a strong year. General Motors couldn't say the same thing, though. It reversed 6.2% after posting a whopping but not exactly surprising quarterly loss. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit Marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for tomorrow. The Commerce Department releases a detailed report on the gross domestic product for the fourth quarter. The economy shrank by 3.8% at the end of last year. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meets with Italian Foreign Affairs Minister Franco Frattini in Washington. And February 27th is National Polar Bear Day. I'm Jean-Luc Renaud.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. General Motors delivered some not entirely unexpected news this morning that it lost almost $10 billion last quarter, $31 billion for all of 2008. Here's another way to think about that, if you like. Each and every one of the 8.3 million cars that GM sold last year worldwide wound up costing the company more than $3,700 to get rid of. The car industry has pretty much become synonymous with Detroit, or maybe it's the other way around. But in his new book about the city, called Getting Ghost, Luke Bergman reminds us that's not true at all. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me, first of all, about the title of this book. What does Getting Ghost actually mean?
Getting Ghost is a phrase that's often used on the street in Detroit and elsewhere to some extent as well. On the most mundane level, it just means splitting. It just means taking off from one place to another. But the young black drug dealers with whom I was spending so much time when I was researching this book use the phrase with, I think, a real sense for its poetry and, you know, for the fact that it sort of connotes a sense of mortality and also that it has a kind of special meaning in a city like Detroit that so many people think of as a kind of ghost town.
You take us through your version of the story of this city with two young guys that, as a matter of fact, you met in a juvenile detention facility. Tell us about them and then what they told you about Detroit.
Yeah, I met them both while I was an intern, a sort of funky PhD intern at the juvenile detention facility in Detroit. And one of them I called Dude in the book, and the other I called Rodney. And what they both did very independently was invite me, after I had met them in the juvenile detention facility, out into their neighborhoods and into their worlds. And most importantly, into their lives as street drug dealers in Detroit. For Dude, just sort of with respect to the nature of housing in a city like Detroit, it was so important for him to make clear to me that though he was working in these ramshackle houses in those kinds of neighborhoods, the houses were not just spots, they were homes. And I think for people like Dude, it's really significant that they are both of those things. It allows young people who are so alienated from the formal economy and who live in a city where they, where African Americans have been so disenfranchised from residential space and from participation in the retail community, to sort of participate in both at once.
Things don't end well in this book for either of these two young kids. But I'm curious as to your thoughts on what it might take to turn this situation around. I mean, there's stimulus plan money going to states and cities. There's talk of rescuing Detroit. Obviously, they mean the car companies when they say that. But what would you do? I mean, how would you fix this?
I am, in a way, more optimistic now than I have been in many, many years. And I think a lot of people would find that kind of ironic. But I think that there are very good reasons for me to be optimistic now. One is that, you know, Detroit has been in the situation that it's in now for many, many years. It has had incredibly high unemployment. It has suffered with thousands and thousands of abandoned buildings. It has also felt, as a bastion of black political power and culture, alienated from the rest of the country. But right now, it feels like we as a city government are finally kind of breathing the same air as the rest of the country. It feels like, you know what, our interests really are the country's interests. And in particular, that folks in the Detroit metro suburbs are now, you know, in as much a panic about the economy as folks living within the city limits of Detroit.
Luke Bergman is director of research at the Detroit Department of Health. He's also the author of a new book about the city he lives in called Getting Ghost. Luke, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
The number of people filing for unemployment benefits ticked up again last week. That bodes ill for the February jobless report we're going to get next Friday. And it reaffirms what has become maybe the signature economic indicator of this recession, that millions of people are out there looking for work. Some of them have no doubt considered going into business for themselves. They'll need an entrepreneurial spirit, money, and just possibly national brand name recognition to prop up sales. Cash Peters wonders whether owning a franchise might be the way to go.
I know. Franchising sounds like a world of exciting opportunity, doesn't it? Elisa Harrison's one of the organizers of the LA Franchise Expo.
They ask people about franchising, they'll think, oh, that's fast food, and it's McDonald's. They think that's all there is. But it runs the gamut from automotive to food to child services.
Gyms, spas, prisons. Basically, I'm not sure about the prison one. But basically, you're buying into a proven business concept. Someone else has already done the legwork. They have a brand, name recognition, and so on. You just come in and leech off their success. I can do that, I thought. I can leech. Cynthia Abbott publishes Opportunity World.
I'm looking for an opportunity.
Grr, I'm really excited.
Think about what you really like to do. What is fun for you?
You know what I really love doing? I love sitting at home, drinking coffee, and eating cake.
You can't make much money doing that.
So I've found.
Right.
Although it actually pays more than radio does.
But maybe a coffee business.
Could you actually run a coffee business where you're just basically eating the products yourself?
No. You have to work.
Work? This franchise lot sounds hard. You work 60 hours plus a week, and it's not even your business. You're still answerable to a dark corporate overlord, the franchisor. Julie Bennett's written a guidebook to franchising.
Not only do you have a corporate overlord, you have an operations manual. You have to paint the walls a certain way. You have to put merchandise on your shelves a certain way.
And what happens if you don't? What happens to you?
You may lose your right to operate that franchise.
You see, it's not easy. Buying into a franchise can cost anything between $20,000 and $2 million, which is another reason I won't be doing it. One of the best ones at the expo, though, was Kelly's Coffee and Fudge Factory, which sounded perfect for me, since it combines a unique business opportunity with the chance to eat fudge all day. Mary Gerlich, the franchisor, wanted me in.
Definitely, if you're interested to follow a proven system.
So if I took over a franchise of yours, and over a period of time I phased out the coffee and the sandwiches, but just kept the fudge?
No, that wouldn't work. We need to have the coffee and the fudge together.
You should rebrand yourself and call yourself Oh Fudge.
Oh Fudge, but then there's nothing about coffee in that.
I don't think anybody cares about the coffee. They just want to try your fudge.
They do. Would you like to sample?
Ooh, I thought you'd never ask. Currently, there are 3,000 ongoing franchises in the U.S. One of the biggest ones right now is frozen yogurt. Swirls, for instance.
Swirls is a self-serve yogurt store. So you come in here, you put the yogurt in your cup, you put the toppings that you want on the cup, and you pay by weight.
So what's to stop me just getting the yogurt and walking straight out the store?
I'm not going to say no one does it. I'm sure people that don't have morals and ethics
will
do it.
It's a shoplifter's paradise.
Probably.
Probably. The other hot franchise is Senior Care. Anything that helps old people through their wilderness years is a real money spinner, apparently. Elisa again.
We have an aging population.
Asian or aging?
Aging.
All right.
And so the services are multiple. In-home care or, you know, adult care services or transportation.
When my family got old and sick, I just moved to another country.
Well, that's an option.
I found that easier than franchising.
That's a personal issue.
Anyway, I ended up very confused, and I wasn't the only one. I found this woman, Kelly Lee, exploring the booth of a restaurant selling environmentally friendly pizzas.
Oh, I'm looking at franchises.
What kind of franchises caught your eye?
Green.
Oh, green? There's a green pizza. I think they just left it out in the sun too long.
But clearly, franchising's not for me. There's way too much effort involved. Julie Bennett.
I interviewed dozens of people for my book, and I asked them what was the hardest part. And most of them said, doing everything myself. I had a corporate staff before. Now I have to wash the toilet.
See, I'm not doing that. But if you don't mind, then try going to your local franchise expo. Cynthia Abbott.
You really do need to do some soul searching, you know, get the groundwork done.
Well, so far I've narrowed it down to yogurt or old people.
How about old people who are eating yogurt?
Well, I thought basically if all else fails, you just give the yogurt to the old people.
Right.
You really don't know what you're doing at all.
Oh, you think? In Los Angeles, I'm Kesh Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, new Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz announced a big shakeup today as she tries to reinvigorate the pioneer internet company. Moved around a bunch of upper-level executives, fired one of them, promised speedier decision-making and more focus on the consumer. The biggest change, though, is probably Bartz herself. After the very, very cautious Jerry Yang, Bartz is very, very different. On her blog today, she promised to make sure that Yahoo, and these are her words, not mine, promised to make sure that Yahoo kicks ass again. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but if I'm Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, I'd figure them's fighting words. My last words today are these. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 88 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ rolled down 33 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 down 12 points. That's a percent and a half. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, how fewer jobs lead to lower expectations.
That's what a lot of people right now are saying. Now, you know what? Money's great. I like making extra money, but hey, I'll take a job paying less for more stability when I know I can bank on that job being here tomorrow.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.